I just love this moment. It's Graham Atwell welcoming you to Sounds of the Bizarre Live. Yes, live. Live internet radio. There's a story to that. I'll tell you about it in a moment. But first, what's the programme all about? Well, it's one of a series sponsored by Emerge. Emerge is a support project for the UK JISC-funded Users and Innovation Programme, which sponsors a series of projects looking at use of social software for learning. Emerge runs on and offline events and other support activities. I suppose the main idea is to support and foster the emergence of a community of practice around technology-enhanced learning. This week, Emerge is running a conference on and offline called Altered States, looking at the relationship between practitioners, innovation and institutions, the complex relationship, as they say. And they've asked us a great honour if we produced a special edition of Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre Live to kick off the week. Who asked us? Well, it was part of the Emerge programme called UIDM, Users and Innovation Development Model. This is a model of activity designed to focus projects development on the needs of users. It's a four-stage model: understanding users, transitions and decisions, technical development, and users' acceptance and support. We'll talk a bit more about that in a moment, but basically we're on the fourth part, the fourth stage of that process now. And as part of that, we're organising a series of Dragon's Den sessions. In a moment, I'm going to let Chris Fowler explain to you what Dragon's Den's all about. But first, yeah. How can you participate in the programme? Well, we've a chat room open now. Christina Costa is there welcoming our guests. Now, to get there, just go into your browser and head over to http://tinyurl, that's T-I-N-Y-U-R-L, .com/soundschat. No password, just put your name in the text field, and I'll give you that once more. http://tinyurl.com/soundschat. Okay, there's more ways you can participate. This is a live program. You can talk to us. We'll be having a bit of a break in the middle to get your ideas on some of the things being raised in the program. And if you want to come on live, just Skype me on Graham Atwell. That's all one word, G-R-A-H-A-M-A-T-T-W-E-L-L. And we'll bring you into the program. Or afterwards, Skype us. We'll be holding our Skype lines open for half an hour after the programme. Skype us and tell us what you think about it. And tomorrow morning, the Skype lines will be open from 9 o'clock UK time, that's 10 o'clock Central European time, to lunchtime. And we'll make up a special programme, a special podcast about your reactions to today's programme. Now, let's go back to that history I was going to tell you about. Well, we couldn't get everyone to the studio tonight to make the programme, so we pre-recorded some of the interviews. That's got advantages and disadvantages. It allows us to do a bit of post-processing about it. And at first, to be honest, I intended just running this off as a podcast. I'd just sit back, let the programme go out, and open a bottle of beer and enjoy it myself. But then I was talking to Christina and others today, and we said that just wouldn't be live. It wouldn't be Sounds of the Bizarre Live. It would miss the edge. It would miss us sweating over whether the sound was going to mess up. It wouldn't be real interaction with you. So yes, we're mixing a mix of pre-recorded stuff and live stuff today. So this is Sounds of the Bizarre Live. And now I'm going to go over to Chris Fowler to get on with it and tell you what the Dragon's Den is all about.
Well, the idea of the Dragon's Den is you have two, three, maybe four experts, the dragons, who then interrogate a victim, a volunteer. In the television series, the volunteer is trying to sell an innovation to the dragons, who are going to decide whether or not to invest in that innovation. So they actually try to sell a concept to them, and the dragons will then question them, probe, and find out the basis behind their innovation and whether or not it'd be worth investing in.
And you've been holding these regular Dragon's Den sessions?
This is only the second one. The first one we held some time ago, and that was when people were about either just put in the proposal or were writing the proposal, so we were then helping them to develop the ideas again, by having, that was face-to-face, we had a number of dragons, and they came in and told us what their proposals were, and the dragons then reacted to that and questioned them, with the aim there of helping them to write a better proposal.
And why do it now? What's the purpose now?
Well, we're coming to the end now, so that was at the beginning of the project. So now we're coming towards the end of the project. People should now be starting to be thinking about how they're going to close the projects, the sustainability issues, the support issues, etc. And this is one way of helping them to begin to think through that and make sure that it's in place for the end of their projects.
So you see the whole Dragon's Den as a dialogic process?
Absolutely.
And what do you see as your role within that?
Well, my role is, as one of the dragons, is actually to ask the hard questions, or hopefully they are, ask the hard questions, to try and get them to think about what the issues are and whether or not they have whether or not they have plans to address those issues or have already addressed those issues. So it's sort of trying to stimulate them into thinking about what needs to be done, whether it's being done properly or not.
Okay, so now you know what the Dragon's Den's all about. But who's the dragons? Are they fierce? Or are they nice? Well, let's let Chris start the introductions.
My name's Chris Fowler. I'm one of the dragons today. My background is in pedagogy and technology. I'm interested in frameworks that help bridge pedagogy and technology. I'm also interested in techniques and methods to support users, and hence my interest in the user engagement process. So I guess I'm sitting here with my UE hat, user engagement hat on, particularly interested in how people are using stage 4 of the UIDM process. We're very fortunate to have, as one of our other dragons, Paul Bailey, who's used to work for JISC in the past, who has a strong background in educational technology and at the moment is running the benefit realisation programme for the Emerge project.
I'm not convinced those dragons are going to roar. They look a bit too cuddly to me. Anyway, let's get on with it. Who's the victim?
My name's Maggie Savin-Baden. I've been volunteered to be attacked by the dragons this morning. I'm the director of the Learning Innovation Group at Coventry University. My previous experience is largely as an educational researcher in the field of problem-based learning, but with a burgeoning interest in learning technologies and the implementation of Second Life to improve student learning.
Okay, you following my story so far? We know about Emerge, we know what the Dragon's Den is, we know who the dragons are, we know who the victims are. What else do you need to know? Well, I suppose it might be a bright idea if you knew something about the project. Well, the project's called Preview, and I'll leave it to Maggie to explain to you what it's all about.
I've used a form of learning called problem-based learning for years, where the focus of the learning, it starts with a problem or an issue, and the students work in small teams. But one of the problems with problem-based learning is that it seems quite intensive in terms of its small group teaching. And people had started to move it into virtual learning environments, which it had made it quite contained and ordered. And one of the beauties of problem-based learning is it's quite a messy and innovative and creative approach to learning. So putting it into a virtual learning environment like Blackboard didn't really help, it hindered it. So when I came across Second Life, I felt maybe we could start to use problem-based learning in Second Life, but I didn't really know how. So the Preview project was designed to work out how we could use problem-based learning in Second Life in a way that improved learning for the students and fitted the desires of the stakeholders who were involved in supporting that learning.
And who are the learners?
The learners are distance students on health and social care courses and on paramedic courses. So it's a joint project between Coventry University and St George's Medical School in London.
Sounds great stuff, Maggie. But before I'm going to let the dragons loose on you, let's clear up a few of these techie terms which I'm afraid you're going to use. Can you think of any techie words you're going to use today? Well, I'll give you one to start with. Second Life. Some of our listeners may not even know about Second Life, and let's try and sort some of those terms out.
Second Life is an immersive virtual world in which you create your own being called an avatar, developed by Linden Lab, for which you can pay for an island and you can teach your students on.
And what's in-world?
Well, when you first buy their island, nothing at all. You have to develop it yourself using an extremely capable learning technologist.
And a chatbot?
A chatbot is what is also called a non-player character, which is a pretend avatar. It's not operated by an individual, which a normal avatar is. It is scripted behind with in a way that enables you, if you ask it a question, it will respond in an appropriate way. And it will also, if you ask it about what the weather is in Bremen, it will go off and get a feed and come back and tell you the answer to that. So it's pre-programmed in a number of different ways.
Cinema.
Is a way of developing films in Second Life using non-player characters or avatars as actors to make the film.
And problem-based learning?
Problem-based learning is a form of learning, an approach to learning, which was developed in the 1980s in Canada for medical students, but has since been broadened out to use in every discipline in every university in the world, where the starting point for learning is a problem or scenario. Students work in small groups to manage or resolve the situation put before them, and they're supported by a tutor who is a facilitator of learning rather than a director of learning.
Okay, enough of the chat. Let's let those dragons go. Get in there, Chris. Find out if her project really is sustainable.
I'm just looking at your five original objectives that you set out. At least three of those look like they're relevant to stage four, which is about sustainability and supporting users, etc. For example, one of your first objectives was to deliver Second Life tools for running problem-based learning. Can you just talk a little bit about what those tools would look like and how far you've got in delivering that objective?
What we've developed is a series of different types of scenarios that we believe work in Second Life. And we've delineated those in terms of different forms of knowledges, in terms of the role of the student, in terms of the emphasis on the type of problem being used. And that's something that we feel other people are going to find really useful when they're developing problem-based learning in Second Life. So it wouldn't be what you might call a classic tool, but it's something that other people are already starting to talk about. The other thing that we've started to develop are machinima that other people can borrow or adapt for their own. And we've got some money, further money from DISC for the benefits realisation, whereby what we've done is we set up a national workshop for people to come and share their ideas, and we shared our own. And also we've extended it to Derby University, who are taking all of our scenarios and looking at how they can adapt them from health and social care to psychology.
I was going to ask that, are your scenarios very specific, or are there some general lessons that you can learn from scenario building generally for Second Life, or are these just specific to health and social?
Whilst they are specific to health and social care, I think what they do is they give an idea of what people can do. Now, some of them we already know that they can be adapted because we trialled them with a group of physiotherapy students in Finland over the summer. And the physiotherapy students understood how to use them, even though they'd have been originally designed for health and care, social care students.
So one of your other objectives was to develop sound practices and guidelines for implementing and sustaining problem-based learning in virtual worlds. So part of what you can do here is abstract from the people trying to use your scenarios certain principles, which can be applied to all scenarios, and then capture those and disseminate them to...
Yes, and I mean, I suppose in the future what we would hope, particularly if we got more funding to support it, would be a space of support for people wanting to develop this work. We're also developing materials that people can take and use, and we're developing a user guide for problem-based learning and a user guide for using learning in immersive worlds in general. And the latter is going to be done in conjunction with Oxford University and David White's project.
Well, it's a habitat
project. That's the
open app. Nice stuff, Maggie. I thought you handled that pretty coolly. But I don't think Chris is going to give up yet. He wants to know more about your dissemination.
How are you going to disseminate that? I mean, it's one thing creating these guides and creating these heuristics, etc., but how are you going to get them out to the practitioners?
They already are. We're already getting a lot of email requests for people to use our information and our scenarios. We've also got our own YouTube channel where we've got demonstrations of all the work that we've been doing that people can use themselves and show. We did the national workshop where we shared our materials, and that was last week. We've also done presentations at the Alt J conference, a number of medical education conferences, a conference in Ontario in June. I'm currently writing a chapter for a book, and in a couple of days' time I'm presenting a paper at the ReLive conference at the Open University, which is an international conference on immersive worlds. So we've done probably in total already at least 6 conference presentations, and there will be at least 3 or 4 papers and a book chapter coming out of the project.
And did you formalise that in a dissemination plan or strategy where you looked at different stakeholders and different means that you could communicate with those stakeholders?
Yeah, and that was all in the initial bid that we put into JISC, because we were very clear that this wasn't just a project about developing a piece of kit. You know, we're in the business of improving learning for students and making sure that it meets the needs of them and the people for whom they'll work in the future, in health and social care and in paramedic training. So we were very clear that we wanted this to have as wide a use as possible.
And did that dissemination strategy survive contact? Did it? Is there anything that you would like to change now, or any lessons you learned from that dissemination strategy, things that didn't work or worked well, etc.?
I think at the moment, my perception would be we've disseminated a lot sooner and a lot quicker than I'd anticipated. The actual project itself and the development of the scenarios happened a lot quicker than we anticipated, which enabled us to disseminate it more widely.
Well, listeners, are you scoring this? I still think the Dragons are losing. I think Maggie's getting them on the run, but they're coming back. Your dissemination's pretty fine externally, but what you're doing in your own institution?
What have you done on the institutional side? For example, your own institution, getting them to adopt Second Life on a sustainable basis?
Well, before we got for this project funding, we'd already bought an island for Coventry University anyway. So we didn't have to do that from scratch. We'd already started that process off. What I've done with the rest of the team at Coventry is we've presented at the university conference, we've presented it at the Health and Life Sciences conference. So I was fortunate enough to be asked to do a keynote within a university conference day. So I was able to talk about it at all of those events within the university. The university also, because we've got funding for an innovative project, I've publicised it so through the Times Higher Education, through The Guardian, through the university newspapers and magazines. And as a result of that, I've had a lot of emails from people. I had a heart consultant at Leicester, a hand consultant from Liverpool who've asked for advice and guidance about how to be involved. Within the university itself, people have come to me and said, I'd like to introduce problem-based learning in nursing on a child module. Can you help me to do that? I've worked with people in theatre studies who are using Second Life for virtual performance, but also want to use problem-based learning as a teaching approach within theatre studies. So there are lots of... more recently, we have an e-commerce module that's being used at a distance as part of an MBA that they want to do as problem-based learning in Second Life. So it's moving in the university faster than I could have thought.
Right. I mean, that's impressive. But that's also ground up, isn't it? I mean, it's people hearing you talk and wanting to use it. Has there been any top-down initiatives from the university?
The initiative to get the island in the first place came from the Vice-Chancellor. Who asked me if I knew anything about it. And when I said, yes, I did, she said, well, I'll give you some money to support it. And I said, how much would you give me? And she said, how much do you want? So that was the starting point for getting the Coventry University Island, which was when my ideas began to click about how we could link Second Life and problem-based learning together. So that happened. And so the University Island has been running for about 2 years now, and we have virtual performances on it, we have problem-based learning on it, we have all sorts of activities occurring on it, you know, and we even now run modules on building in Second Life for students across the university to take it.
Now, the more astute amongst our listeners might have noticed there were supposed to be two dragons. What's happened to the other one? Well, Paul's waking up and he's in now, into the fight.
Looking at institutional support, do you feel that the institution will support you to embed stuff within the University of Coventry?
Definitely. The Vice-Chancellor was delighted when we received this first piece of funding, and the subsequent small pieces of funding that we got to develop Preview further, she was pleased about. And it was on the basis of that kind of development where we were able to go for other funding. We're currently looking at going for other projects which use learning and technology and development together, and the Vice-Chancellor is very supportive of that work. And because of, you know, she's the top woman and we've got her support, you know, that is a great boost to this research. Well, it's a kind of research and development unit.
Okay, those dragons have purred, haven't they? They've purred all over the dissemination and institutional embedding. Time to change track, I think. What about the help and support for people using the system?
In terms of the individual rather than the institution, how did you go about supporting an individual within Second Life? Did you have help systems within Second Life itself to, if something went wrong, and how did you implement those help systems?
Well, I think the first thing we did on the project, well, alongside the development of the scenario, was just to develop our own orientation sessions on our islands that were connected to the Preview project, because we felt the Second Life orientation itself was too clunky, and we wanted to be able to allow our students into an orientation session which would be meaningful for them and their learning, and also at the end of which they would undertake a mock scenario as a practice session before they did the real scenarios. So we front-loaded it, I guess, is what we did. Then once the students are in world, there would always be a facilitator there, but we would always have a learning technologist on hand as well. So when we were doing the trials, that's what we were doing, so we had both.
Sounds fine to me, but I'm still left wondering, did the students like it? Fortunately, Chris asked that question.
It was varied. The first group that we tested was surprised how little support they got from the facilitator, which again, I think, raises issues about facilitation in Second Life. Can feel very different from facilitation in face-to-face PBL. Some of them were wanting more cues. Some of them felt that... some of the ones who'd had gaming backgrounds were expecting things to be hidden in filing cabinets or desks, and they weren't. And they were kind of confused by that. So we thought maybe that was something that we could actually bring in that we hadn't thought about. In general, they were quite positive. There was one scenario which was largely my idea and was entirely my mistake, which didn't work at all, which was around quite a rude chatbot who we call the scenario the unhelpful manager. And it's a chatbot who is only there for a given period of time. And if the students ask a question and he's scripted behind to respond in particular ways, largely unhelpful. But the students were really disconcerted by this because he was too rude. If you met somebody in real life, it probably wouldn't come across quite so rude, but because it was in Second Life, it changed the dynamics. And so we've had to really rethink that whole scenario, and that's what we're in the process of doing at the moment.
Well, it's still looking pretty good for Maggie, but Maggie, did you have any problems in this project? It can't have all gone that smoothly.
I had a few challenges on my hand to start with in terms of... we didn't have any problems with the firewalls. It was perfectly open. But because Second Life do regular updates, to start with, we had a lot of problems with getting the IT services to update them. So the interim measure was to have a Second Life lab at which wasn't attached to the university server, which we have full use of and which we use for all our testing and continue to do. We had another testing day where the paramedics here used the scenarios for St George's. So we brought the two projects together that way.
Evil Live Internet Radio with your host Graham Atwell and producer Dirk Steerglitz here. Well, I hope you enjoyed that first part of the show. We certainly did. And there's been a fair bit of feedback going on, and we got a few people lined up to chat for it with us. In a moment, I hope we'll be talking to Heike. And in fact, we are talking to Heike. That's mighty fast. Hi, Heike. Hello, Heike.
Very nice to hear you. It was wonderful to listen to this.
Where are you talking from tonight, Heike?
I'm actually in the south of Germany, near the French and Swiss border, Freiburg im Breisgau.
Okay, Heike. And what's your interest in this program?
Well, the great thing about what she just related was her process of actually getting that. What really was exciting was to hear that professional approach on how to get funding. My word, that was incredible.
Oh yes, she goes about it, doesn't she? And Second Life, I think, Heike, you're using Second Life yourself, yeah?
Yes, very much so. And in language learning, problem-based approach is the finest of arts, I can think. And looking at the machinima that she posted on the preview website, could one say that students' learning pace is accelerated by that? Is it really true, what you're saying, Graham, that students learn 10 times faster with this approach?
I think 10 times may be pushing it a bit, Heike, but I certainly think there's a lot of interest there. But I think we need a lot more experiments before we can really work that one out. What's your feeling?
Well, the one thing that really puzzles me, to be honest, is because we're seeing in Second Life the medical emergency. We see a person lying on the floor getting treatment, and we see his wounds, we see his somebody pulling out one of these injections. Sorry, I don't know what the English word is for that.
Syringe.
And putting it into exactly. And you wonder, Second Life, there is no medical emergency. Does that really fit?
You've done a brilliant lead into the next part of our programme, and we're going to be talking about some of that. I've got our time here. Thanks for coming on, Heike. We're going to have to move on now, but I hope we'll chat to you again soon on the programme. Please come on a future programme.
Thank you. It's been very, very interesting. Thanks, Graham.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, who's next on the programme? Well, I think I'm going to try and talk to Nurgis now from Turkey. I'm just going to ring Nurgis now. Let's see if we can get her on the phone. It's ringing. Hi, Nurgis. Hi, Nurgis, you there?
Hi, Graham. Just turning off my... Just a second. iTunes stream.
Hearing you lovely, Nurgis.
Great.
And where are you based, Nurgis?
I'm based in Turkey. I was actually a neighbor of Heike, but I didn't know her at that time. I moved. I was in Freiburg and moved to Turkey last year.
It's a small world, and as part of Sounds of the Bazaar, bringing that small world together. Oh, thanks for the plug. And you're also doing things with Second Life, I hear.
Yes, I did a trial course last summer, a six-week general English course for pre-intermediate students, and it was an experiment, and I loved it, and I'm planning to continue with it.
It's interesting how many language teachers seem to be using Second Life.
Yes, there seem to be a lot, but most of them are still exploring. I couldn't find so many teaching, really. We're trying to bring them together a little bit with our SL Experiments project and wiki. We have weekly meetings. There are, of course, some schools which are well-known, like Language Lab. But, I don't know how many teachers are actually teaching.
Notice one of the issues emerging on the chat room is people are saying, okay, but schools are blocking Second Life, how easy is access, etc. Have you found that a problem?
Well, it's not a problem for me because I'm a private tutor, so I don't have anybody. I'm not at an institution where they would tell me, you know, you can't use it, it's blocked. I'm accessing it from home, and my students were accessing it from home and not from university, so I don't have that problem.
But they're finding that the connections are good enough.
Yeah, most of my students were from Europe and the Middle East, and none of them really had access problems, except occasionally, maybe during one session. I'm planning to offer business English courses, and that might be a problem if that is offered during work time. That might be a problem because a lot of companies block Second Life.
And lastly, notice, because we have to move on, but what's your view on this problem-based learning idea that Maggie's been talking about?
It's a great idea, and I agree with Heike that it enhances learning, also learning languages. But it needs a lot of resources. I think that's the problem I see at the moment.
Yeah, well, one of the things we want to do from our Emerge point of view is begin to link up some of the project work going on in the UK, which has had a relatively high level of funding, with other countries outside the UK. So hold on to that spot, and we'd like to really look at that. And I know there's a lot of questions emerging in the chat room, and I'm going to be looking over the next couple of days at how we can start developing those links outwards, Nergis. But it would also be great to be able to hear about some of your experiences. And I suppose there's one thing I can announce here, that Emerge in the past has been a rather closed community, or certainly on the blog, and that's opened up now, and anybody can join the Emerge community. So www.giskemerge.uk.something.uk, you'll find it on Google search, Nergis. So perhaps if you could go over there and link up, that'd be great to have you there.
I'll certainly try that. Thanks very much for coming on the programme tonight. Thanks for the invite, and thanks to Chris. Bye-bye.
Okay, nice one. Thank you. Okay, that was Nergis from Turkey, and I think I've got just about room for one more. There's been some great stuff going on in the chat room. People talking about access, what kinds of problems they're solving, how could this work for teachers in school where SL is blocked with difficulty, I'd say. People saying it's generating a lot of activity. I'm going to come in the chat room myself in a couple of minutes. But we'll be looking, I think I'm going to be putting some of these questions to Maggie, and I'll see if I can get a short follow-up podcast session with her to answer some of your questions, which I think are quite important. Oh, and somebody said, please ask about permissions to use voiceover IP in the Middle East, which is prohibited. So you can still see some of the technical problems. One last person on here. I'd really like to get my old mate Andreas Ausvater on the programme tonight. I'm hoping he's going to be there. And I'm ringing. Andreas, you there? Come in, mate. Love to hear from you. Well, he's still ringing away there. Andreas, where are you? And this is the problems. Andreas, you there?
Hello, here is the Skype voicemail box from Andreas Albert. Wenn Sie möchten, können Sie mir gerne hinter dem Signalton eine Nachricht hinterlassen.
Andreas, is this really
the email? Hi,
Graham. Right, this is not a BBC radio programme. We are not leaving rude messages on any Skype email boxes for anyone who knows what the BBC governor's chasing after us. Andreas, great to have you on here live.
Sorry, I missed the button to switch the iTunes off at the right moment. So I got a bit confused.
Hey, it's okay. Everyone will know it's really live. We're not just going to pre-recording, Andreas. Andreas, how are you enjoying the program so far?
Yes, in fact, I must say there were a lot of questions in the chat now, and that's the first point I missed, really, that it's recorded and not a live session, so there are a lot of questions that people had.
Yeah, I know that problem, and we were hoping we could get Maggie in the chat room tonight, but she had another engagement, and it just wasn't possible. But we'll be looking at all those questions and going back and trying to ask her some of those and come back as a follow-up, I think.
Do you know how they handle the openness in Skype and the question of trolls and people who are getting inside such groups? So it would be a question for other people also.
To my mind, they haven't had a troll problem. You'll be picking up some just after the break. Some of the issues they have had with using bots, actually. Themselves, chatbots, but I don't think they've had a troll problem, but I can see that as being a problem. I mean, I suppose if you use closed islands, that's one way around it, but then that reduces the openness, doesn't it, Andreas?
Well, yes. So I talked a lot with Nuggets about this problem, and she told me it's a lot of personal work keeping the people outside or explaining what we are doing, and that this moment is not a funny, jokey moment. It's a real teaching scenario. So maybe there are a lot of people in the chat having a lot of ideas about how to handle this before we throw out the child with the bathtub, as you told.
I think one issue for me, I suppose, is that looking back from earlier experiments with Second Life and multiple user virtual environments a year ago, we seem to be getting a lot clearer in ideas of how these things can be used for learning.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm glad to move on, but Andreas, a last plug for you, I suppose. You know I love your podcast, and what's it called, Andreas?
Yeah, it's called Bildung im Dialog. It's a German-speaking podcast, and maybe you enjoy it.
I do enjoy it, and I've nominated it. It's a Pontedusky nomination for EduBlogs 08 Awards. EduBlogs 08 Awards, of course, are the awards for blogging in education across the world. And nominations open to the end of this week. Our own lovely Josie Fraser is one of the co-runners of the award schemes. You can nominate to the end of this week, and then they'll be voting in December. And we've nominated Andreas's in the category of Best Educational Use of Podcasting. So plug now, get out there and vote for Bildung und Dialog. Yeah, I didn't know I was going to give you that plug, did you, Andreas?
Yeah, I feel a bit shy and red now.
Okay, it's lovely to talk to you tonight, Andreas, but we're going to have to move on, I'm afraid. Otherwise, this program's going to run on forever. Okay, cheers. See you soon, mate.
Cheers, cheers.
Bye. Okay, this is Graham Atwell, Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre. Don't forget that the Skype lines open immediately after the programme or tomorrow morning for you to give your Skyped comments about this particular broadcast. And we'll be putting it all together in a podcast and also asking Maggie to give us some of the feedback on the questions you raise in the audio and some of the questions which have been raised in the chat room tonight. But now I think we're going to go back to our main feature tonight, our main feature about problem-based learning and the use of Dragon's Den and Second Life. Okay, let's go back to the programme now, Dirk. Maggie's sucked those dragons in. Chris is supposed to be giving her a bad time, but now he's more interested in Second Life than asking about the project.
Second Life has good enough voice quality, does it, to be a problem-based learner? Or using text-based?
Well, we've done both. And actually, we've gone back to text because we find that the voice seems to interrupt the sense of embodiment that we were getting within it as a learning medium. We'd quite like to explore that further. We don't quite understand it. But so we'd use text and then we moved to voice and now we've moved back again. And even the meetings, the project meetings that we hold in Second Life, we don't use voice, we tend to use text.
Chris wants to know more about Second Life. Can you really do all this in it? What's the problems, he says, about fidelity? Funny, I've never heard of it, fidelity. I always thought that was something about trust. But it's interesting the way Chris puts it.
Is there a problem of fidelity then? I mean, and where does that become a problem? I mean, at some point it's not the real world, and you can improve the fidelity of the objects, whatever, so they become more realistic in some way. But is there a limit to how far you can go with fidelity, how far you can go with problem-based learning in a virtual environment because of fidelity issues.
Yeah, I think there is. But, I mean, I think the advantage it is with the paramedics that if they kill the avatar, at least it's not a real person.
But there's a probability they're more likely to kill the avatar because it's not a real person. It's not behaving as a, you know, in an appropriate way.
Well, they have been quite distressed when they have killed somebody.
Hmm.
So I think there is that element. And I think also in things like archaeological digs, the fact that they cause less problems if they do it virtually.
But archaeology and perhaps medicine has a... You have to touch people, you have to feel people, do you know, and see symptoms, etc., which might be hard to do in a...
Yeah, I think it is, but I think, you know, with the pressures on healthcare, with the legal issues that we're increasingly facing in healthcare in the UK, I think there has to be some kind of safety. There's an increasing problem that students aren't able to practice on people. A, for there aren't enough, there are too many students and there are not enough patients. And also, in terms of the legal side, what students are and are not allowed to do these days. So I think it does provide a jumping off point for, you know, giving them opportunities to practice things they wouldn't have been able to. And I mean, you could also argue that some of the things that we've done in the past, you know, in Skills Lab, where students practice injections by using oranges, you know, you could question the fidelity of that, really. You know, because real people move and scream and jump and oranges don't.
Pause back in the action. He wants to know if there's any link between problem-based learning and Second Life. How do they fit together, he asks.
Well, I think, for me, there is. I mean, I think there's a very strong link between the pedagogy of problem-based learning and the kinds of learning that work well in Second Life. So I would argue that trying to do lectures and podcasts and multiple guest sessions in Second Life, it is not as useful for student learning as the kinds of dialogic learning that occur through small group work, project-based learning, and problem-based learning, for example.
Paul's getting into this now. What he wonders is the link between research, educational research, and development work in things like Second Life. Surely that's two different worlds.
Just looking at your sustainability or your where you're going to go with the project, Maggie, I know your interests are mostly in the research and looking at to improve the pedagogy in that. But a lot of what you've just, a lot of what you've been describing is also about supporting other people to do this. Is there a conflict there in what you will do to follow the research angle or to actually support other people to implement these sorts of scenarios in Second Life?
I'm a great believer that you can't do pedagogic research properly unless you're improving student and learning and staff development. My heart has always been in, you know, improving learning for the student, and whether that's in development, which I've done an awful lot of education development in problem-based learning, until I realised that my heart was actually more in educational research. But I think this preview project, when we got the funding for GIS, my only sadness in getting the money was there wasn't a small research arm to the project. But because we've now got funding to do a small piece of research, I think we can show that, we hope we can show what the impact is on staff and students. I think educational development is fantastic, but a lot of the time in higher education, we don't know whether it's effective or not. We don't know what the impact is on people. And for me, what's the point in doing it unless you know that it's making a difference to staff and students' lives?
So you think it's important to have funding streams that allow you to do the educational development and the educational research in parallel?
Yes, absolutely. And I think a lot of funders have missed the trick there. We've got funding for another project by the Levy Hume Trust, which is all research-based. So again, you tend to have everything polarised. It's either development or it's research.
And how long is that research?
That's a 4-year funded project to look at the socio-political impact of learning in immersive worlds.
Paul likes that reply. But I really think these dragons have blown it, you know? They're supposed to be asking hard questions. Paul wants to discuss this issue. In fact, he wants to tell us about his ideas now.
Can I bring us back? Because I think there's a good point to be made, and if we can try and capture it well, about this link between the educational researcher and the educational developer, and the need to have projects that are funded along both of those streams. Because for a long time, I felt that the hard research funding goes into new research that has very little impact down the line on practice, partly because the practice moves on too quickly. And on the other side, we're doing a lot of practice-based research, and GISC does a lot of this, that doesn't, as you say, have the strong evidence coming out of it that actually makes people to have those two working in parallel. Can you?
Yeah, I think what tends to happen, I mean, it's my perception, I've no real proof that this is the case, but my perception is that what tends to happen with development projects is that the research done associated with it is generally an evaluation. It's not the kind of research project that really looks at what is the impact on staff and student, what is the longevity, what is sustainability of the project. And I think what I guess I'm hoping with a project that we've been involved in here is that we can start to look at some of that. Who else is using it? Has it been useful? What have they changed? What do staff and students think? And I think if you have the kind of model where you fund something for 18 months and then you give further funding, which actually looks at sustainability in terms of implementation beyond the immediate institution and in terms of a research project which has followed it through but actually comes out the other end and looks at it in terms of impact factors.
It's pretty clear the dragons like what they've heard, but what about the future? Can they support a community in the future, Paul wonders?
And what about, you've been very successful in building a very enthusiastic and quite large community of interest around your project, around problem-based learning and your second life. How do you see yourself supporting that community, or could it become a self-supporting community of its own from the members and the people who are interested?
I wouldn't have said that I'd particularly develop that. I think there are two things at play here. One, I think, is the Emerge community, which was developed through GISC, which has been a tremendous support to those of us new to learning to use some of the kinds of technologies that we weren't that familiar with, or being able to ask questions which seemed quite naive about the use of Second Life and why people were using it. And one of the things that I thought was quite a stupid question initially, which turns out wasn't entirely stupid, was, well, what's the pedagogy behind this, which was another interest. So Emerge has been hugely helpful in helping to develop a network of people who I think wouldn't have come together before. I'd never have met Dave White at Oxford or Ian Trulove at Leeds if it hadn't been through the Emerge community and everybody else that's been involved with it. So that's one part. And I think that in itself will offer some kind of sustainability. I mean, I'm already looking forward to the wrap party, to finding out what people have done and what they're going to do next. So that's one piece. I think the other thing is, because I've been involved in problem-based learning for 20 years and I've written books on it, people are always kind of interested in what I'm up to next. Although in many ways I've kind of left problem-based learning behind a bit to do other projects, people are always saying, Maggie, what are you up to with PBL at the moment? And so it's given me another edge to what I'm doing. So I've had the opportunity to speak at an international conference in Singapore about this kind of project because it's PBL and that's what I've been doing for a long time. So the problem-based learning community are interested in this and therefore they will take it forward and they will say, can we have a look at your scenarios? Can you come and talk to us? If you can't come and talk to us, can you tell us somebody else who's doing it, who I can meet with? Those kinds of things.
They're thinking about the future hard now. Could Emerge be some help in this?
If the Emerge community can be supported, extended and opened up, that would be something you would find valuable as a research, educational research community.
I would be delighted. I think for me it was a really forward-thinking and vital innovation which has not only brought people together but has sustained people. And I now meet people at conferences who are part of the Emerge community who were going on to do other things, and or people that I would know who I would want to collaborate with for bids in the future because of the Emerge community. And even, I think, people that I'm now supporting to write. I mean, because I like writing, I enjoy writing, and I enjoy helping other people to write. And there are people in the Emerge community who say, well, you write loads, how do you do it? And I just said, well, if you want some help, I'm quite happy to mentor you. So there are other knock-on effects which I don't think people even realise are happening. Maybe they do, but I think there's some fantastic things that have come out.
Okay, we've looked at the communities, but what about opening up the project for more subject areas? Could it be taken outwards?
You're doing the project with the psychology people as well at Derby. Are there any other subject areas that you would really like to explore with problem-based learning in second line?
Yeah, well, veterinary medicine, I think, would be an interesting challenge. Then hand surgery, we've got somebody interested, but we can't work out how to get funding to develop that. But that would be another one. So I guess interesting areas of science that I wouldn't normally be involved in, I think. Yeah, or physics. I think you could do some great physics problem-based learning scenarios in Second Life. So those are some of the areas I'd be interested in. I haven't given it a huge amount of thought. I've gone with people who've come to me who are interested and gone with that interest first. But there are a huge range of people who are interested in developing it. Well, we have got the funding to support it. So,
yes, they like it. Those dragons are really purring. They want Maggie to do more dissemination to build on this work. But listen to how she turns this question back in on them.
But I guess my concern at the moment is that beyond the funding period, there isn't a lot of support to roll it out further. We're already working with Derby University, but I think that if there was more funding to disseminate, actually an awful lot more universities would use it, but they would need support from us to start the development off and to understand how to use the chatbot technology that we've developed, how to use it, how to embed it within the curriculum, how to use it for distance education.
Is that a message you would feed back to GIST, that actually they should be spending more funding on the dissemination side, the communication side, and less on the development side?
I think you have to have good development in the start to start with, otherwise there's no point in disseminating it. But I do think that there perhaps should be a round of funding at the end of this project which says that, you know, if you've started and can demonstrate a reasonable dissemination process that's being effective, that they will give you a top-up grant of, say, 50k to develop it to, say, another six universities. Mm-hmm. Now, that would be a real carrot, and it would really make the whole users and innovation programme meet, I would say, more of its aims and objectives.
Well, by now we're running out of time, and that's really it. Maggie's got to go to another meeting. But before she goes, I want to get rid of those dragons and ask her, in confidence, how she thought it all went.
Maggie, now we got rid of the other two, what was that like?
It wasn't as bad as I was expecting. I think part of it was because I'd met Chris before and I'd spoken to Paul on email. And so I guess I knew a little bit about them, so that helped. I think the thing that was most helpful was that it really crystallised my thinking about the future in a way maybe I hadn't before. Things like, I kept thinking, why don't GIST give us a bit more money to make this work better for longer? That was one thing. And the other thing was, who else can I get to use the stuff that we've spent all this time developing? And who else can really implement it in a way that would be useful.
But I thought there was a bit of a conflict coming, because I thought, especially Paul, they were pushing you to say you were going to work on the project after the funding, because that was part of the deal. And there was you pushing back, saying, yeah, we'll work on the project, but give us some more money. Didn't you feel there was a conflict?
Yeah,
then?
I don't often think we get that kind of conversation with a funder, though, or a potential funder. You know, I can't actually say to Leverhulme now, I've got the money from them. Oh, can we just have a bit more to carry it on for another year? They won't do that. Whereas sometimes with the Emerge community, you've been able to go back and said, what is the likelihood? I've had an opportunity to voice what I think. I don't know whether it will be followed up, but being pushed to think about what I'm going to do after the project ends, I think introduces questions to the dragons about their responsibilities to me and to other people involved in the emerging issues community.
So then the whole thing's a two-way process. It's not them coming to push you. It's as much for you to push them back.
Well, I hadn't thought a bit about it that way, but yeah, I guess that's the case.
Well, there you are. We're coming to the end of the show now. It's been a pretty interesting experience for me. First fly-on-the-wall radio programme I've made. I quite enjoyed it. Well, I'd like to thank everyone who made it possible. Thanks to Paul. Thanks to Chris. And above all, thanks for Maggie for allowing herself to be publicly put through that inquisition. Hope you enjoyed it. Been great fun. Our next live programmes will be from Online Educa Berlin on the 4th and 5th of December. We'll be broadcasting at 11 live from the conference, 11 o'clock Central European time, 10 o'clock UK time. Don't forget to listen in. This is your host, Graham Atwell, signing out from Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre. Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre was produced in the Pontedusky studio. It is released under a Creative Commons 3 license. Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre was introduced by Graham Atwell, and the producer was Dirk Stierglitz.